Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A mixed week for markets. Earnings season scorecard, here you go. A high jump over a low bar. Listener questions and a random hodgepodge, all this and much more on episode number 633 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a good welcome to you. Thanks for joining me. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Been here for, so many times, 633 episodes that were going on. I hope everything is good with you. And again, thanks for joining me. I got to tell you, it's been a busy week for me. This will be my fourth podcast this week. So I did the Disciplined Investor last week. Then I did DH Unplugged on Tuesday night. Then I had Frank Curzio's podcast. Then I had the Investor's Business Daily video podcast. Then I had the regular Friday pre-market rundown for trigger charts I did. Wow, lots going on. So yeah, I was on Frank Curzio's podcast. That was pretty good. We had an interesting time. One thing, Frank and I were talking, and somehow the topic came up of how long we've been doing our shows and you know, how long this whole thing's been going on, how long you've been podcasting. Frank's been doing it a long time. And I had a look. And when I did look, it was some question that came up also earlier in the week. It was actually in March of 2007. That was the premiere episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. How do you like that? 2007. I didn't really realize how long it was, how far back it went until I looked. I mean, I was blown away myself with this. Here's Frank and I talking about that exact topic right now.
You know, I love
listen to this.
Known each other for a very, very long time.
Forever. So, you know, hey, by the way, I did a little research. Somebody was saying, hey, you know what? We just had our anniversary for our podcast for X amount of years. Do you know the first episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast was in March of 2007?
Yes.
March of 2007.
Because I started doing it a little bit after you, and I think 2008 I started at the street, and that's how we got to know each other. You were at the street, and then I think you were doing interviews there or something. I don't know if you did like a video there or something, but then
I was on for something. But you know what? I'm saying it. I'm the OG of financial podcasts.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's funny because people come to me and say, wow, you've been doing this for over 10 years. I was like, I've just been doing it for 11. So, I don't say that to everybody. I just say it to them personally. So I'm like, yeah, I'm a pioneer in this industry. No, actually, you're the pioneer. You've been doing it even longer. And it's amazing how everyone in the world has a podcast now, right? It's
everybody,
a platform that's like, what is it? A podcast? And now it's every show gets turned into a podcast.
So and during Frank's show, it was a great show. We talked about trade wars and the economy, and we talked about a few stocks, everything in between that too. And I thought we would, first of all, put a link to that episode on the Disciplined Investor. So you go to the show notes of this episode and you can check that out. And here's a quick clip of some of the discussion we had when it came to the idea of a trade war. Now, let me set this up a little bit. We were talking about the trade war, the idea of what happened with the skinny partial deal and all that. We were talking about, you know, was it a win? Is it good? And I brought up the topic of intellectual property and technology transfers and equating and evening up the whole idea of trade. And I said, well, where is that? And then I wanted to talk to Frank a little bit about the idea of, well, what about other kinds of copyright infringement, as well as possibly the idea of IP theft that's going on in a different way than you would think.
But
so this is what we talked about.
I want to throw this at you.
The big deal is IP theft, right? Or some kind of copyright infringement, copying products, selling it from China, right?
That's a big deal. Yep.
Big deal, right? Big deal. We both agree with that. I agree with that. But how do we know exactly what's being stolen or not? For example, what about house brands? And what I mean by that is just this happened just 2 days ago. I went to Best Buy and I was needed a bait freezer for fishing. You know, one of those outdoor stand up bait. These are important issues. Okay.
The 1% life, man, the yacht club.
Yeah. Real life problems, man. My old freezer wasn't working the way I wanted
God
to.
Damn okay. It. Yep.
So I need it. They're not expensive. They're $250. You put it outside the last couple of years and that's it. But you know, keeps the bait outside, the stink outside. So I went to Best Buy and I originally had an Igloo. Okay. They had an Insignia on sale. It's the house brand for all sorts of appliances and TVs for Best Buy, right? You've probably seen those. They have TVs and all this. Insignia. So I bought this new freezer. It looked exactly like the Igloo that I bought. And I was replacing the Igloo, which is a Texas company manufactured in, I think it's Katy, Texas. Knobs were all in the same place. It looked great. So did Best Buy copy this product, get it manufactured in China, and had it sent back here? Or did China develop? I mean, is that like IP theft through China?
I think IP theft is more about how many illegal Apple iPhones and how some of their companies are create. Like if the laws were a little bit, and again, now you're really messing with culture when you're telling how a country how to police people. But when you look at the movies, right, copyright infringement just everywhere, right? I mean, there's streaming services right now. You can go through China and download every single movie. Let's be real. You're looking
Like bags, like Gucci and Prada and all
that. Bags for all of that. So you know, some way that they could, you know, listen, you get punished even further. Again, that's hard to do, right? It's like another country telling us what to do. Hey, you know what? Those people should actually get a minimum of 5 years in jail if they do that. But, you know, we want to – that's – when it comes to that intellectual theft, that's where it's hard. It's how do you stop that, and how
do you stop it?
How do you
copyright infringement?
How do you monitor? How do you monitor it?
I don't know.
That's how. How do you know that that's working if you come with a deal? So, I agree with you at that point. Where 2 points I want to make. One is yes, physical only a small thing take, but you got to look at the bigger picture here, right? Because they had a clip of Trump at Minnesota when he was doing, you know. I mean, his rallies are incredible, right? 34,000 other people are thinking. But he's actually saying he was going off on Biden's son. That whole thing was in the media now. Again, I won't get political. But one of the things he said, he's like, imagine those guys dealing with China. Because I got to tell you, China, those guys know how to negotiate. These are the most difficult guys to negotiate. They know what they're doing. I mean, so you're seeing positive things being sent out at both sides instead of negative tweets like, hey, I'm not going to do a deal in China and China ripping us apart, where I think this is a big step to basically shake hands and say, okay, let's work on this further. And that can't be lost, because that's at least now we're both at the table. We're both friendly compared to 3-4 months ago, where back and forth, new tariffs are coming out. So I like that they actually sat down and shook hands and said, okay, let's work with this. I think that's a big step. You're right.
I agree. No, I totally agree.
So much has been done. But for me, for everyone to be, you know, trashing this and saying, oh, well, nothing's really getting done. We'll see in 3-4 weeks if anybody like backtracks or whatever. The other thing too that you mentioned.
If they do, hold on a second. If they do, if this deal does, this little partial skinny phase one deal gets shredded or reduced further, what's your comment going to be at that point? Let's kind of get this on the table now.
All right. On that point, China's market's going to crash even further. China's dead.
So as I mentioned, I was also on the IBD, the Investor Business Daily video podcast that they do. Great. They do a great job of the production and, you know, the guests they bring on. And I thought it was really a great interview. They do an incredible amount of pre-interview discussion. So for example, we had a pre-test that we had to do about a week ago for quality of video and make sure everything worked out. Then we'd had another one, I think a third one. And then I had to be available 15 minutes before, just to make sure everything was working perfectly. It was pretty good. I mean, in the end, it was fine. It was flawless. We just went through it. Their production team did a great job. But we did have a discussion, because I said to them when they asked me for, hey, you know, we do these three sections, and one of the sections is going to be a discussion about three stocks. Can you give us three stocks? I said, well, can I give you a short candidate? well, they don't really do that much. And it's a really, markets are in an uptrend right now. And therefore that's not, but okay, you know what? Sure, no problem. So this is the discussion we had about a recent short pick and how it played out and why that particular position was chosen and some of the technical research that went behind it.
Let's talk about an interesting trade that you made recently. And this is really, and this is a great example, because when we were talking about this before, we'll talk about this in the current stock section, but you asked, hey, could we show an example of a shorting stock? And usually like, we don't necessarily do that. But, you know, in the end, I realized, you know, the market is a little bit more treacherous. A lot of growth stocks are doing very well. And in the end, you are following those trends right there. And so let's talk about one stock you shorted recently, Planet Fitness. And mm-hmm. you're able to do, you capitalize on just by following the trend right there.
So by the way, a short is just look at the same tools and techniques you use at IBD, turn the chart upside down. Yep. And therefore what you have is the exact same rules to follow of a breakup or a breakdown,
yep.
right?
Yep.
So one of the things we looked at was Planet Fitness. There was really going sideways for a while. There really wasn't a lot of action that I saw a couple of months back. And I looked at the stock from the perspective of that generally it has some good fundamentals. However, it really was not performing well. There was a variety of areas within that stock chart that I looked at. I was looking at a daily stock chart that showed me kind of holes and areas of weak points, weak areas of support. Yep. So what we did is we waited for the stock to kind of climb up towards the 70 zone or so. And looked at that as the opportunity to short. We thought the thesis behind it from a fundamental standpoint, if we were going to make a story out of it, was that, hey, what happens when all and if all these various companies like a Peloton or a Tonal or the Mirror yes. start really infiltrating the households and people say, you know what, we can run outside. I can use my Peloton. There's a lot of apps out there. Maybe I don't want to go to the gym all the time. Maybe there's some issues with subscriptions if, in fact, we see the economy roll over. And the stock started moving in our direction. And I looked at that and I said, you know what? When we get down past approximately the 60 range, that's probably going to be my profit zone on it. Got down to, I think, about 56 or so. Took it out at about 60 and then started bouncing back a little bit. Had an upgrade the other day. Was up a few points on that. But it does, I mean, you look at that. I'm looking at the chart right now that you're showing me here. I mean, you see some triple tops there. You see a downward action. You have a downward sloping 50-day moving average. Things are not looking really that healthy for this stock. Fundamentally strong, but otherwise it doesn't really have a good look to it at all from a purely technical standpoint.
Yeah, and I think a couple of other really interesting points, and you mentioned the triple top. It really, you waited for a downtrend to truly be established first, where it started making lower lows and that 50-day moving average to actually be in a downtrend too. And that's right. when you act. You know, a lot of people, once again, a lot of people get ahead of the trade and they'll say, hey, there's Peloton out there, the Mirror, all these things. I'm gonna short it when the stock is in a strong uptrend, right? You have to have that patience to finally see it on the chart and the price action to actually begin the downtrend. Because a lot of people, they're always going to try to short at the top, buy at the bottom. But you're going to do really well if you wait for the trends to actually form and then start acting on those trades.
So there you go. There you have it. If you want to listen to and watch, because it is video for the IBD, it is audio for, although Frank has it on YouTube as well, we'll have both of the links available in the show notes over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com for episode number 633. Now, aside from all that, what happened this week? Kind of had a mixed bag of economic news. I guess that's the best way to put it, because when we look at some of the things that have been coming out over the last few weeks, there's definitely been some weak spots that are showing up with regard to the economics here in the United States. And that has become a bit of a problem because the idea that has been put through the system for some time has been that, you know, while the rest of the world is really weak and there's concern about a slowdown, you know, in Europe and China and in Japan, as well as the emerging markets, the U.S. has been incredibly strong. And therefore, we have nothing to worry about. Because somehow, magically, we are an island unto ourselves. Now, we've talked about this, 100 times if we talked about it once. But over the last couple of weeks, we've seen that there has been a pretty good change to the feel of what's happening with economic indicators here. So what we saw this week was retail sales was probably the biggest issue that I saw as a concern. And this is a big problem. In fact, we saw that a negative 0.3% print on a month-over-month basis versus the expectation for about plus 0.3. So if you just simply subtract that, you have a 0.6% differential from expectation to where we are. Now, here's the problem as I see it. We had embedded in all of the discussions that the consumer was really holding up the economy. The consumer was the last part of the wall that was holding up strong, holding out all of the slowdown that we saw around the world. And if we can continue to do so and if the consumer stays really solid, then we're not going to have a problem. And now we see some cracks that are developing in that wall, in that dam, holding back this massive slowdown. And in particular, analysts have been really, really talking about this a lot. The whole idea that the consumer, add to that the employment situation at a 50-year low on the unemployment rate. We're seeing another 150 to 200,000 added to the payrolls each and every month. So therefore, consumer sentiment is high, and we really don't see this as a problem because the consumer is really what our economy is all about. And now all of a sudden, we're starting to see that there's something going on that all of a sudden, retail sales are coming in. Now, on top of that, we saw housing numbers. The housing starts disappointed. Building permits were a bit better. Industrial production, negative 0.4% versus expectations of negative 0.2%. Capacity utilization also missed estimates. The Philly Fed, lower than last month. And finally, on Friday, we saw that leading indicators came in at negative 0.1 versus a positive 0.1, which were the expectations. So now we're starting to see that even though the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index moved higher, we've talked about this. If you look up some of my discussions on this from the past, but once we start seeing that there is this idea that the Citigroup Economic Index slides and analysts are really off by estimating too much and the economy turns, they start to change around how they're doing things. They get a little bit less concerned. They bring it down. They're always behind the curve is the point. Without the whole discussion, just let's say that economists are behind the curve. And being behind the curve, what that does is it's always going to kind of throw that economic surprise index off. In fact, when it's really high, you should be concerned. When it's really low, you should be concerned. There's no neutral ground on this. The bottom line of this, though, is that analysts have been coming in now too excited about the economic condition in the United States. So what does that, but what does that all tell us? If you wrap all this up, we talk about the retail sales and industrial production, and we saw that the manufacturing numbers, the ISM and manufacturing and the services index came in and disappointed the last couple of weeks. What is it telling us? What's the bottom line here? So what I see is that while we have a really good employment condition here in the U.S., right? We talked about that. We said that just a minute ago. Employment's holding up well. Unemployment rate is low, multi-decade low. The internals of the economic system are softening. They're rolling over. Then we have China. Last week we saw, towards the end of the week, that China announced their GDP numbers. A couple of the numbers involved that too. Retail sales were better than expected. Some industrial production numbers were better, but their GDP came in at 6%. Now, we would kill in the U.S. for a 6% GDP. But realize that China has been a developing nation for a long time. Their GDP is growing dramatically as they are continuing to build their economy. That will start to naturally slow down, just like we see in every other developing nation that has gone from emerging or even to a point of, let's go back to frontier markets, the beginning stages of any development, into emerging markets, into developing markets, and then into developed markets. We're a developed market here in the U.S. Japan is a developed market. Europe is a developed market. China is developing. Some of the areas in Asia are emerging. But you would expect that over time, the GDP would start to slow down as they have an aging population, as they change their country's focus from an export-driven country to a domestically-driven country. And the problem, though, is that number that we just saw, that 6% print, was the lowest level since 1992. 1992. That's 27 years, a 27-year low. That's not so good. That's not so good at all, man. So, you know, you can make this case that this is all leading to potentially more stimulus. And central banks are going to be on the offensive here to lower rates, which they are, and provide, more bond buying and, you know, other kinds of words of enthusiastic opportunity where the lower rates. And I think that's important to understand. This is important that we are seeing that central banks are, in fact, doing this. But, you know, there comes a point sometime in the future that an economic slowdown can no longer really be tamed by a central bank. It can't be solved in any way by central banks just simply going out and buying bonds through quantitative easing programs, expanding lending. I mean, there's a point that I don't know where exactly it is, but there's a point that this stuff has a diminishing return. And it seems like we're getting a little bit closer to that on a regular basis. Yeah, I know there's this talk out there that, you know, the economic cycle has basically been eradicated, that we no longer have to worry about the whole idea of an economic cycle that will be, in fact, coming and going from recovery to peak to trough down to recovery again, and, you know, the whole S-curve of an economic cycle. This thing has been totally eradicated. Central banks are now, they've got it down. They got this deal down. Somehow over the last 10 years, they feel that, you know, we have whipped and basically put to bed the whole idea that there will be this slowdown. We're going to smooth out the economics over time so that we don't have any of this. There may be some slowdowns here and there. There may be a little bit of overstimulus going on that we actually get too quickened of a growth. But generally speaking, we're not going to ever get to the point where we've seen that we get over the top into an overheated economy or into a really, you know, deep recession. The levels of peak to trough to expansion and growth are compressed. What we have here is the potential for some slowdowns, but they'll be shallow and brief. That's what they're all professing. Somehow they've figured it all out. And all it requires is a very active central bank with tools like interest rate, the ability to change interest rates and to print money. You know what I say? Hogwash. They're full of crap. Because there's more to the economic cycle than just monetary policy. I mean, clearly, yes, we could look at things like fiscal policy, but we're really focusing in on the idea that central banks believe they got this whole deal. You know, they're done. They got it. It's all good. It's impossible because they're leaving out a good amount of factors. And one of the biggest factors I think they're leaving out is the whole human element, the psychology of humanity. You know, you can have things like euphoria because things are going really well with your business, your job, your family, everything in life, and you feel like you could freely spend. But there's things that are outside just simple interest rates. I mean, when's the last time that you sat down and said, you know, the Fed's going to be reducing interest rates. I'm going to go buy that extra thing that I wanted to buy. I'm going to buy a better steak because the Fed is doing quantitative easing. I'm going to go on an extra vacation because, you know what? I think the Fed is in a loosening and a dovish stance. I mean, do you think that way? Do you think people really think that way? I don't think so. I think what people are really thinking about is how there's an impact on the financial condition overall when the Fed is being very lenient and loose. But they don't make day-to-day decisions. Their day-to-day decisions are made on, hey, do I have a job? Do I have enough money to pay for my bills? Am I happy in life? Does the opportunity for me in the future look bright? And they take that information and then they utilize that and put that into that psychology of their own money and what are we going to do in terms of spending? And things can happen. People can lose jobs. Now, that's why there's so much focus on the idea of making sure we have full employment. Because full employment solves a lot of problems. Full employment really does, in fact, create a high level of positive thinking for people that are employed, outlook for the economy, and of course, that trickles down into sales. Consumers doing their thing. But when people lose their jobs, maybe have problems at home, don't see a great outlook in the future, that could change things. And no amount of interest rate cuts or quantitative easing can help any of that. These are the variables that the Fed just cannot control, no matter what they do, no matter how much they talk, no matter how much of a carrot they really put out there. There are variables of the psychology of individuals that really are the consumers and the end of where we're looking at, of that final wall, that dam, that, you know, the baseline of our economy that they can't control. Now, we need to also separate this whole idea of where the economy is in the short term from where the stock market is. Now, the Fed can, in fact, by their very nature of providing cheap money and stimulus, can help and basically push up the valuation of risk assets. So we know that. I think that's a reasonable understanding. I think there's an agreement about that, that is a possibility of what they can do. So when stocks can go up, the economy can weaken for some time. There's the ability for that to happen. But does the Fed actually have the ability? Do they have the ability? Have you ever asked yourself and thought about this? To control the economic cycle? Again, hell no. Nope. Cannot do it. Listen, how do I know that? Horowitz, what are you talking about? Everybody's saying the opposite. Listen. They can't even predict a near-term slowdown like we saw at the end of 2018 and the potential for a slowdown in 2019. They were all about a predetermined course of interest rate hikes because the economy was doing well, expanding at a good clip, inflation was moving up, unemployment was moving down, and they didn't see any end of that, and they kept talking about a predetermined course. This is not just the first example. There's many examples in history that we have seen the Fed just being just outright wrong, unable, just terrible at forecasting anything at a reasonable level. They're constantly adjusting their models. If they had any ability to really forecast, they'd be a lot closer to reality. Even in the short term, forget about the long term, they're just way off on that. But even in the short term, they're terrible. And that's because they cannot quantify that one area. That one area of the human element cannot be quantified by them and put into their models. I mean, in the end of 2018, they had a reverse course and they had to get up there and in a panic, they had to go and actually start saying, you know what? Markets are coming down. They did this more for the markets. But we see that there is the potential for a need for us to have a less hawkish stance. And no longer are we going to have the consistent rate hike talks that we've had before, because that's not helping anything. Nobody's being helped by that. Markets aren't being helped by that. We see that maybe the economy is softening a bit in certain areas. So you had to pull that. And as you hear the whole, and you listen to this idea that the Fed has got our backs, I've said it 100 times, right? The Fed's got our backs. At least that's the perception. Remember that they're the ones that usually are in the make it and break it in economic cycles. They've caused more recessions because their inability to really forecast, and they're overshooting and undershooting. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they let the markets lead them around by the nose. And a lot of the make and breaks, and particularly the breakdowns of the economic cycles that they have caused, is not necessarily due to their deliberate actions. It's because, again, their inability to control people, the human element, the psychology of money, finances, that is inherent in everything that comes to the that flows into the economy. Now, give them some credit. They are, and they recently, well, under Bernanke's date, I think it was Bernanke, they instituted this communication strategy, this whole idea that they're going to communicate more, they're going to kind of do a forward guidance to try to make sure that people understand in advance what they're doing. The idea that they can hold a carrot ahead of us and lead us around is really the whole idea of the communication strategy in order to, you've seen it. I mean, we get the parade of Fed walkers all over the place on Friday because they're going into a quiet period into their next meeting. They can't have any announcements a couple of weeks before their next meeting. But before that, oh man, they're talking all over the country. They got lunch over here. They got a breakfast over there. They're on that TV show. They're on this TV show. They're making comments about, well, yeah, we think that we're not on a predestined course. And the other one said, well, we need more stimulus because the rates are higher around here. We look at the another one's talking about the Taylor rules, and it just goes on and on. So just remember that the Fed itself does not have the power. Human nature is a lot more powerful over all this. And the economy is, in fact, rolling over regardless of how low they take interest rates. And let's take this to its fullest extreme. What we've seen in Europe is a negative 0.5% now rate in a bond buying program that was reinstated again recently. Their economies continue to look bad. Low rates are not necessarily the answer. High debt is not the answer. In fact, it's quite the opposite. When you have rates going up and you noticed how well the economy did, when they started increasing rates, you get the velocity of money that starts to move. Now, I'm not saying you have to overshoot it, but there's nothing wrong with having a normalized rate and actually increasing rates, pushing people to, now you're hurting people, herd, H-E-R-D, not hurt, H-E-R-D, hurting people into the idea of, hey, you know what? Rates are going to go up. Let's do something. Let's get something done here. I mean, essentially what the Fed is doing is they are stoking the whole idea of deflation. If they believe that, well, deflation is one of the worst things that can happen, and we want to stay ahead of it, we need to keep inflation growing, we're going to do so by debasing the currency, by quantitative easing, bond purchases, and lower interest rates. Hello? Not working. You want inflation? You want people going to buy things? Make them believe things are going to be more expensive in the future, not less expensive. I mean, that, come on. Common sense. Common sense. So we think they're making the wrong moves. We don't think they should be increasing rates at this point, but definitely not decreasing rates any more than we have. The problem, of course, we have is the rest of the world is doing it. And if we just take notice of this and find, okay, well, the rest of the world has done this. What's happening? Things are not good. Europe is falling apart, caving in. Japan has never gotten out of its economic doldrums from back 20 years ago. So maybe the Fed should stay out of it. I'd be happy for a while. Let's do an experiment. 1 year, no Fed. What do you think? One of the crazy ideas here at the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Let's take a little move over to, let's talk about the markets. Seems to be a lot of confusion right now. People are, I think people are confused. I get a lot of emails and questions. You may be one of them. I mean, are you asking yourself right now, hey, is the market overvalued? I mean, should I be putting more money to work now? Should I be pulling money out? Should I be taking some profits? Should I be maybe adding to positions? All good questions. Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for you. Because it all depends really on your time frame and your risk tolerance. You know this. However, I think I could help a little bit. So let's say you believe that markets are overvalued and you're worrying about losses. Okay, that's a good starting point. And maybe you believe there's a good risk, good amount of risk out there. And you think that, well, I could take some profits and wait for a better time to invest. Maybe that's something that you're thinking about doing. Here's the deal. As long as you're disciplined, you have a plan, and most importantly, you act on that plan. Really, really important. A lot of times people have plans and they write it down and they think about it and they go through all these gyrations with either themselves or their planner, but they don't actually act on the plan. Because again, getting back to what we talked about earlier, there's a lot of psychology that's involved in all this. And sometimes that psychology gets the best of us. But as long as you're disciplined, have a plan and act on that plan. That's the most important. Because what's the opposite? What's the other side of that equation? Essentially, it's flying by the seat of your pants, right? Just not having anything really that you're going to work on, hoping that things will work out. And it's a foolish errand. Or is that a fool's errand? I think it's a fool's errand. It's a fool's errand. I've told you in the past that we've reduced our equity exposure in our TDI managed growth strategy. I mentioned that because of the way that we've structured the analysis technique of screening for stocks, a lot fewer stocks have come through that screen. And as such, it's a natural way for us to bring down exposure when fundamentals are not meeting up with what we believe should be the qualification to get into our portfolio. Now, that doesn't mean it always works exactly right, but what we found is when we have a reduction of this, that then leads us to act on our plan. But what about other strategies, for example? Because that's easy. I've told you about that. And it's pretty much, this is what happens. And if this happens, we do this. So we act on that. What about other strategies? You know, more generic strategies, which like our global allocations or investology. And I can only talk to you about that and, you know, what I do, of course, because I don't know what you're doing. So what we did there is we shifted risk. And we took it down a notch. So let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the most conservative, you're in money markets, 10 being the most aggressive, you're in, I don't know, small cap growth or emerging markets, 100%. You know, kind of crazy outside boundaries. And the 5 is a moderate risk, maybe part bonds, part equities, blended around, diversified pretty completely. So what we've done is we've actually taken whatever particular number maybe is the most appropriate for you on a risk tolerance and time horizon basis and shifted it 1 left. Therefore, technically, there's no 10 anymore. There's a 9. It's technically a -1. But what that means is that we actually reduced exposure somewhat to the more aggressive positioning sectors, asset classes, within a portfolio for our clients. And we did that because we were and are concerned about valuations. But at the same time, we did so in a way that we still maintain some exposure to areas. And we tilted part of the portfolio towards value from growth. And that means that we've actually, the intent is to reduce risk down. Anything can happen with either the growth side or the value side. But the intent was that what we've seen historically is that value will oftentimes hold up better during market downturns. Not always, but it on average. That if we're looking for stocks to sell, we see that oftentimes when you have the highly overvalued and high PEs and those with less earnings, those can get really hurt very significantly. Whereas value stocks, because they maybe pay bigger dividends, maybe because they have a lower price to book, lower PE, these are the areas that I think would be more beneficial in if we do see a market turn. At the same time, we also found that value has really underperformed significantly to growth, and therefore the reversion to the mean trade is kind of in there too. So what we did was we kind of kept the same amount of exposure, but changed how that exposure resides within portfolios. Now, the whole point was not to say, oh, you should be going into value or growth. Forget that. I'm just telling you what we did. The point here is that I want to know what you're doing and what you've done with markets nearing all-time highs and valuations potentially stretched and all the uncertainty we've seen. Are you just sitting on your hands saying, you know what, doesn't matter. I'm in this for the long haul. I'm 25 years old. I'm 30 years old. And it doesn't matter. Well, that's okay. If that's the way you think, if you were okay with that, if you could sleep at night, if that aligns with your risk tolerance, your time horizon, hey, terrific. However, the question is that while we're seeing earnings come in better than expected for about 83% of the companies that have reported, we also know there's a good deal of that is due to the fact there was a significant reduction of estimates over the past couple of months. So we have this very low bar that now we're jumping over. We've seen this every single quarter over the last several quarters. Earnings are expected to come in 3% lower on a year-over-year basis. And that's what's happening, even though companies are beating. So what I'm saying is this. Stop hoping and start getting disciplined. I mean, this is your future, right? I mean, we're talking about your future, your money, your role in this. If you're managing this on your own, are you doing a good enough job that you would hire yourself again to manage your portfolio? Are you doing the best job if you can? And if not, why? Why not? I mean, you should be taking this seriously. This is serious stuff. This is your money. It's your future. It should be working as hard as it can, appropriately, again, for all things considered, risk and time horizon, all that. But are you spending more time actually, I don't know, planning a vacation or making dinner reservations than you are each and every month, every quarter, every year, looking at what's going on within your portfolio, whether or not you're doing it yourself or with your advisor, whether or not, you know, you just simply are a buy and hold or a sector rotation or rebalancing, or I don't know, what is it that you are in fact doing? Or do you just pretty much just throw your money in, throw it against the wall, and man, I am hoping for the best. Because that is not a plan. That is not discipline. That is nothing that you can actually act on anytime in the future. That's just hope. Hope is not an investment strategy. So I think now is the time to get back to some basics and maybe think about making sure that you're spending at least some time monthly, once a month, if nothing else, reviewing your portfolio, seeing where your allocation is. Try to set it up in some kind of a visual presentation that's easy for you to deal with. I like charts. I like pie charts. I like beer. We know that's from. I like pie charts because it gives me a really good visual representation of where my portfolio is. But whether or not you like that, a tabular view, a table view, it's up to you. But do something. Get back to your basics and spend some time planning with your portfolio. And trust me, it's definitely going to pay off in the long haul. That's the whole point here. The long haul. Your security. So just check that out. All right, next up. We are going to some listener questions, and I got one, two, three of them that I thought were pretty interesting this week. You'd always send me a question, a comment over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a little button there that says Ask Andrew. Just click that. And when you do, a little form will show up, and you can just send me whatever you want. And we do that so we have a history of that so I could reference those in the future if I ever want to look at those and pull something out. We actually had some situation last week where something wasn't going through, but the forms were all there. They were held, so I was able to pull that out. The first one's from Joe K. He says, hey, I just finished listening to your podcast from yesterday. You talked about the decaying value of VIX indices if you hold them for long periods of time. And I was wondering if you would put inverse leverage ETFs like SQQQ, SDAO, SDS in the same category. This is a great question. So pretty much all leverage ETFs have some potential for decay because of the way they invest the underlying. However, commodity-based leveraged ETFs have a much greater potential, particularly the VIX ETFs. But commodity-based oil as well and any other leverage has a much greater potential for decay. These are only supposed to be accurate on a daily basis. If the oil moves up 2%, the triple would move up 6%, and inverse would move down 6% for the day. It's supposed to be as close as they can to the actual performance multiple on a daily basis. The VIX is a whole different deal because they invest in the short-term VIX versus the long-term VIX, and that doesn't even work sometimes. Now, when it comes to the other ones that you've mentioned, like SDAO and SDS and SQQQ, I don't have as much of a problem with those at all. I don't see as much decay in that. You can hold those for a pretty decent amount of time. But just know there is some slight decay, and we'll call that the cost of doing business with some of these. Some are better than others, so you want to watch which ones you're using. But I think that's a good question. Next one is from Daniel D. He says, hi, Andrew. I was thinking back on your podcast you did a few weeks back when you mentioned index funds. This came as a suggestion for investors that are just starting out and don't have capital to purchase a large enough stake. How would you evaluate index funds or other similar vehicles that hold a group of companies? Love the podcast. I'm definitely on the Andrew train. Hey, when it comes to the Frank versus you view on China. Well, thanks. I appreciate that, Daniel. Let me just go back to this. How would you evaluate index funds or other similar vehicles that hold a group of companies? I mean, index funds are pretty easy to understand. The ones that invest in the S&P 500, there's a few of those. What I would do is look for primarily, you can look at the holdings, but really look at the volume of what's traded. That's an important feature. You want to have good volume. You want to make sure that you always have a decent amount of volume so that this thing doesn't have just some kind of crazy move if markets move one direction or the other because of gapping and nobody wanting to buy that particular position. The second thing you want to look for is fees. So look for fees, find the lowest cost with decent volume, and that's your index fund. Now, it all depends on what you want to invest in. Do you want to invest in the S&P 500, the Russell 1000, the Russell 2000, the Russell 2000 growth, the Russell 2000 value, EFA world net, there's billions of them. So it all depends on what you want to invest in, but I would look at the volume, the performance against a benchmark, and the fees. I think that's the three things you really want to look at. This one comes from Kim M. And Kim writes, hi, Andrew. In your previous podcast, 632, yeah, that was last week's, right? You discussed buy vol and buying call options on the VIX with a strike price of 20 to 22 out to the end of December. I was curious why you would buy the option out of the money as opposed to in the money. Thanks for all you do. I've been a listener for several years now. Hey, thanks for listening, Kim. I do appreciate that. What you're looking to do on this kind of situation when you're buying vol, there's a lot of ways to skin the same cat. But if you can find something outside the money enough in certain circumstances, what will happen is if you do get a spike in vol, you'll get a really big, gigantic move in those that are out of the money because they're so cheap to begin with. Now, when you buy the ones in the money, of course, they're going to move theoretically as much as the amount of the index, but you will notice on VIX options, you don't usually get that. Sometimes what's happening is that VIX options will actually move, especially those that are in the money. But what's happening is the understanding is by the VIX community that it's going to come down over time. Because really the only thing that happens that will really move the VIX is not just a move down or up of the market. You could have a 0.25% or 0.5% move on the markets, and the VIX does nothing. The reason is it's a volatility index. So what you're really looking for here is the volatility factors involved in the markets. And as such, sometimes even if you have a VIX that is elevated, you'll see the actual option won't play as well. So what I'm looking for here is a snap volatility and spending a little bit amount of money versus a lot of money, which oftentimes you'll have when you're at the money on the VIX. Now, again, you could do this in a lot of different ways. If you buy at 20 and theoretically the VIX is at 23, hopefully you'll be at 23, but that's not always the case, right? $3 you'll be. So it would be $3 in the money. But sometimes you're at like 210 because there is an understanding that volatility usually subsides. So what I want to do is go out of the money, look for that pop, look for that major turn on that option as it's getting closer to at the money price. So if I could buy something at 25 cents and now it picks up to $1.50, that's a big percentage gain win versus going from $1 to $1.25. So I hope that helps. And that ends our listener questions segment. Make sure to listen on each and every week to DH Unplugged over at dhunplugged.com. Check out my Twitter feed. That's simply Andrew Horowitz. That's one word, Andrew Horowitz, no spaces on that. And send in your questions. Of course, if you have any desire to look at some of the strategies that we're doing, how we're diversifying, what exactly is happening, our long, short exposure strategy, Investology, which is a more diverse and sector allocated portfolio, minimum of $10,000. Go over to investology.com, check that out. Lots that you could do there. And you don't, by the way, you could go there and just simply, you can log in, register. There's no cost to do so and start checking it out and see how this actually develops portfolios. That's the cool feature of this. You can actually go and develop a portfolio on the fly by answering like 10 different questions. Works really nicely. We built it to do that. So with that, I bid you adieu, and I will see you next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.